Welcome to Film Fight Club. I'm Glenn Falconstein from Falcon Screen, and we are joined by Sydney filmmaker Chris Evans.
Hi.
Freelance writer and critic for Rotten Nehru.
Hello.
And resident 2SER critic and broadcaster and everything about town, Stephen Hill. Stephen, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, good morning, everyone.
So we are here with our first special. Actually, we had a few special Sydney Film Festival episodes, but we are coming at you now for an hour. If we're on radio, a little bit more on the podcast, took all things Sydney Film Festival, which is in full swing. We'll be joined at the beginning of the segment by the Film and Revolt crew. Film and Revolt, filmandrevolt.org is a group of young people who are passionate about film, who focus on film as regards youth programming, but also film generally. Their coverage is great. It's very extensive. And we will be going to their interview and discussion in a moment, which took place at the Festival Hub. And then we'll be returning to the 2SER studio with four of us to chat a little bit more about reviews and some of the things that we have seen and some of the things coming up over the next few days at the Sydney Film Festival. We have with us Tiana Malhotra.
Hi.
Amy Lehman.
Hello.
And Amelia Pieri.
Hey.
So before we are at the Sydney Film Festival, it's been full swing. It's been a lot of fun. We're at the Festival Hub. Do come find us. It is a great environment here. We're going to talk about the films we've seen, what we will be seeing at the festival. But first, can you tell us a little bit about Film in Revolt?
Okay, so Film in Revolt is a not-for-profit organization, and we provide a platform for young creatives to gain access into the film industry, to network, to gain access to filmmakers and interview them and expand their knowledge.
Wonderful. And that's filmandrevolt.org.
Yes, it is.
So first of all, tell us about some of the flicks that you've seen so far. It's a few days in, you would have caught some stuff, so what have you seen?
Well, I haven't seen anything yet. I'm looking forward to White Crow in the next few days, and High Life, and also the Agnes Varda retrospective, which I'm really excited for, and seeing Cleo from 5 to 7. So, looking forward to those ones.
I think we're going to High Life too. I think it's probably one of the highlights of the festival.
Cleo from 5 to 7 is one of the highlights of my life. That's like one of my top favorite films ever. So, yeah, you're in for a treat.
Great.
Yeah.
And yourself, what are you seeing at the festival?
So I've already seen the Minuscule movie, which was amazing. I loved it. And I also just saw Tito and the Birds, which was also fantastic. I love animation, so it's so good to see some of that in the festival.
Are you catching the anime film? I've forgotten what it's called.
Children of the Sea?
I did have a look at that. I am interested in maybe buying a ticket for that. It looks really good.
Tell us a little bit about Minuscule, because I remember seeing it in the program, but I haven't had the chance to see it yet.
Yeah, so I loved the TV show when I was younger. I loved the animation. And this film, it's crazy how they can make a feature-length film out of silent bugs. And they did such a good job. It's a second film as well, but I think it's better than the first one. It was really funny as well. Loved it so much.
I'm curious, is this one that might appeal to people not just across age ranges? Because certainly that's what it's billed at.
Yeah, I think my parents both loved it. I think it's something you can just watch, just enjoy, just like follow along with the story. I was really invested in the bugs. So I think the story is, it's good for all ages. I really enjoyed it.
Beautiful. And Tiana, what have you caught so far at the festival?
Okay, so I've seen quite a few screeners. I saw Dirty God, directed by Sacha Polek, which was really great. And Vicky Knight is heading to the festival, so that's really exciting. And then I watched Anna Kokonos's Blessed, and then tomorrow I'm watching Third Wife, and next week Queen of Hearts.
Now, we actually have caught Dirty God. What did you think? It's the director and the star, yes, are absolutely coming out. What did you think of playing in the official competition? What did you think?
I really liked it. It had really lovely emotional beats and seeing her evolution. I guess accepting her identity with the disfiguration, which is really fascinating. Really sad, though. But Vicky Knight, I thought, did an amazing job. So it was really interesting and captivating watching her.
We have a new addition to the panel.
Yes, we have a new addition. Freelance writer and critic Rotten Nehru has arrived for Rot. Thank you so much for joining us. Just say hello to the crowd.
Hello.
So yeah, we're just squeezing some space in here. That's how we go to the film festival. It's all a bit of fun seat of our pants. We are talking about Dirty God. I really liked her performance in this.
Yes.
I really liked the direction. I think it's one of my favorite films that I've seen so far at the festival. And it just struck me as that it didn't... What I loved, it didn't treat her as a straightforward character. There were parts of her character which were upstanding, but there were parts of her character that were also
very redeeming.
Right, and sure. Yeah, she's really nuanced in that, like, she wasn't just a victim that we sympathize with, because some of her actions kind of make us question exactly where she was. And I think that was really good because it gave an unflinching portrayal of her instead of just, you know, romanticizing what had happened.
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I'm really keen to see how this will play before a crowd. I think it will be one of the highlights of the festival. And so tell us, and I think you mentioned you were seeing, there's actually fortuitous timing, because you mentioned you were seeing The Third Wife and Queen of Hearts. I think Virat has caught one or both of those, is that right?
I caught The Third Wife. Did you catch it?
Yes, I did see The Third Wife. It was unfortunately not my most favourite moment in my life, but yeah. Queen of Hearts was... Yeah, that was quite something too. So it's an interesting, what should I say? Third Wife was tiresome, but yeah. It's okay.
Well, what you'll find the more you listen to us over the course of this interview is that we're just cynical bastards about everything. So we were hoping that you could inject some of the vitality of youth into the proceedings with some enthusiasm for the festival.
No. I mean, just to be safe, but like Third Wife is beautifully shot. It's very picturesque, and there's some mastery in the way that technically how the pictures come together. But I just wasn't on board with the very heavy-handed social commentary that's trying to push times.
But we hope you enjoy it more.
yes, we do. So we are going to talk about the film festival generally. Now, they've in the past few years tried to pitch the festival at a younger crowd, and certainly there is a strand focused on young people. And I'm very curious, we are very curious, to what extent do you feel the festival is or could be catering to young people?
Okay, well, I think they're doing... Well, a pretty good job at the moment. They do have the youth event on Sunday, which I think quite a few people are heading toward. Yeah. I guess now that I'm over 18, I'm watching everything that's, like, not meant for youth, so it's, like, a little different.
Yeah.
But aside from that, I'm definitely seeing a lot more younger crowd every single time I go, which is really great.
I think a wider sort of social media kind of personality for the festival has brought a lot of, Sydney youth in. And... you know, the increasing wide range of films that so many different subject matter and directors really brings in a wider audience. So that includes a lot of youth as well. So I think it does a great job of that.
Well, my friends and I, we're lucky. We go to school right near a theatre. So we've been planning just after school one day go see one of the films at the festival. And I think social media has helped us. Like, we see a film that's on at the festival. We're like, yeah, that looks good. And then, like, let's go Friday night. And so that's been really good. We just, like, make plans. So I think it's something different for us to do, not just go and watch a blockbuster, something more interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I remember a few years back, everything, you had to be over 18. Like, I remember looking in envy at the Sydney Film Festival program and thinking, oh, pity I can't go to anything. I remember also a few years back seeing someone being turned away when they brought kids to The Tale of Princess Kaguya, which is definitely a family-friendly film and a great film, so it was sad to see. So I think it's really good that they've introduced... I think that it's really the government have gotten on board with letting people go to unclassified films if they're under 18. And, it's really fortunate for the youth now. And it's good that Sydney Film Festival is changing their marketing up and, as you say, giving more of a social media presence.
Talking of younger audiences, I mean, we're quite young, right? I mean, we're not that old yet.
Yes, we are.
But also, like, generally, because, you know, the average patron age for someone going to Sydney Film Festival, it is... you know, the other side of 50. So from that perspective, you know, you are talking, when you're talking younger crowd, you're talking about us as well.
Not the young crowd.
Hold on to that.
Yeah.
But actually, you're right. I mean, it's thankfully, they don't check your IDs or whatever. Yeah. So, you know, you can pass off.
To be clear, without advocating anything.
But, you know, if you want to see a film, but, you know, you're mature enough and you want to see good cinema, then... age is not a number, it shouldn't be a thing.
Yeah, fair enough. I agree. And I remember, like, when I first started Film Revolt, like, in 2016, I used to email Lee for, like, stuff I wanted to watch, and she'd respond, like, Tia, you can't see this. It's, like, R18. So I'd, like, all my films would be, like, cut in half, and so I'd only watch, like, half of what I wanted to originally watch. But now it's nice, especially because I've got way more films that are not 18+.
I think also changes in classification brings a wider audience to a wider selection of new ideas that doesn't limit them to like quite general films. So, yeah, I think it's great for the youth.
I think I'm too good. I mean, a lot of discussions. We were talking about Rocketman immediately prior to this discussion, and certainly that among many films, there have been huge discussions about the appropriate classification in Australia.
I'm generally on Virat's side of the issue, where, as you say, like you get exposed to a broader variety of themes. The films at the festival often aren't going to play at general cinemas, and you know they're showing you a much broader idea of cinema and a much broader amount of ideas about what the world is and what we can do to change the world. So, I think it's great that young people can go in, and I encourage them to keep breaking the laws.
Again, not what we're actively advocating.
Glenn's the lawyer of the group. Just you know.
I mean, you're not breaking the law if you're doing it for cinema. Right.
Right.
It is for art.
Tell that to the judge.
Art for art's sake, right?
It's definitely in the Crimes Act somewhere. So, It's a couple of amazing weeks coming up. We've talked a little bit about what we've seen. Moreover, what are you excited to see or what do you hope to catch in the coming days?
Well, I'm most excited for interviewing directors next week, which I'm really excited for. And I don't know, I'm really interested in foreign films. So I think that kind of influenced what films I chose for Sydney Film Festival because I just can't access it otherwise. So that's why I chose Third Wife and Queen of Hearts for sure, which I'm really excited to watch just because I don't have access to it.
Same. I would go to a cinema and you'd see blockbusters and
exactly.
A lot of them would be not from... Japanese cinema is my favourite among many films.
And I can say that when I was a teenager, the amount of films that were available at... I guess it's different with Netflix and such now, but at the cinemas and what got released to DVD, there was a much broader amount of art house stuff than there is now. So I think the festival has become really important. And it couldn't have come at a better time for younger audiences to be allowed in.
I think you make a very good point, Grace. I mean, there was a time when we were growing up that we had, you know, Civic Blockbusters and we had SBS On Demand, which still showed proper, good classic, you know, foreign cinema.
And a much broader range of foreign language films and independent films were released in arthouse cinemas in, you know, 10 years ago than they are now.
Now, Amy, I know we spoke a little bit earlier about the films that you're excited to see, but if you had one recommendation or even two recommendations for people listening, what would you say seek out during the festival?
I think seeking out the Agnès Varda retrospective is really important because it reinvigorates her importance as a French filmmaker and brings new life to her films, which I think is really essential.
Mm. That's a timely retrospective, not just because of her death, but yeah, at a time when we're putting more and more attention on female filmmakers and the importance of representation, Agnès Varda was someone who really fought to break down barriers and was also a genius. So yeah, I agree. It's really important to pay respect to her work. Speaking a bit more broadly outside of the scope of the festival, I'm interested in how you guys became involved in Film and Revolt and how your interest in cinema started out more generally.
Well, I started maybe like a year ago. My friend told me about Film and Revolt. He was a member. And he said, you know, if you really want to get involved in film and see more films and get into like the crux of the film industry, like just give it a shot. I was lucky to meet this guy, and then he told me about it, and then from there, just kind of got bigger. And I've always been interested in cinema, but I feel like I've really learnt about film since, and I've been able to speak to some really inspirational people who have given me really good advice for what I do. So it's helped me practically, and it's helped me like being able to speak to people like that I don't know, and like I've done some really, really nerve-wracking stuff, and then I come out and I'm so happy that I've been able to do it. And a lot of people are really surprised to see like a teenager like in front of them or interviewing them, and I think a lot of people like talking to just a teenager and just chatting about film that they love and then I love as well, and it's been really good.
So I've always been interested in film since I can remember. I remember going to Blockbuster and like looking through all these crazy films with my dad and watching so many classics. And I was lucky to
meet Lee's daughter through school. And that's how I came across Film and Revolt originally. And I've been doing it for such a long time now. And it's really, as Amelia said, has like broadened my experience of film. And I've had so many amazing opportunities, especially with the festival in previous years. And yeah, I think it's just really essential to have a platform like this to bring more exposure and awareness to youth about the broad range of films that we can access. So,
Well, I got involved accidentally. I was browsing for film festivals for teenagers, like, ages ago, and I came across Film and Revolt because we had, like, an entire article dedicated for film competitions for teenagers, and then it had, like, a little thing. It was like, if you're interested in joining, just email us. So I did, and then Lee got back to me, and then it just, like, started from there. And I think the most valuable thing about Film and Revolt is that having the access to have conversations with talent, filmmakers, producers, because all of a sudden these careers seem viable to us. Because otherwise, how else can we get access to being able to like talk to Academy Award winning directors and get some advice and their insight into the industry?
Wow, I mean, listening to you guys talk about how you first got involved in movies kind of made me feel really sad, because it made me miss the time that, you know, I got to just, you know, involve myself in the magic of cinema, because now I get to see so many movies and we become these jaded film critics and take ourselves too seriously, and we kind of miss the first kind of initial impressions of why we love film. And it was basically the magic of the movies. It wasn't anything to be a film critic. It wasn't about, you know, talking about how bad The Third Wife is or how bad Queen of Hearts is. It's just about, mostly about how amazing cinema is and what cinema can do in bringing together people. It brought us together, after all.
That's right.
It did. I still feel some magic. Some is magic.
Yeah, you want to be transported, but it's funny. The more this goes on, this life of judging the movies, the more you'll find people start to take it as a badge of pride of how cynical they are. So yeah, try not to lose the enthusiasm.
Well, become that person.
That's why I think Sydney Film Festival is so good, because you just, for that time it's on, you're just immersed in films and you see all the ads, you see all the press. Like, I'm seeing Final Quarter soon and I've seen all the press for that on TV, and it's just like everyone's getting behind it, like all these young people, Film and Revolt. It's just like immersive for the time the festival's on. Like, it's just film, 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 and it's so great to just be in that little world.
Just wondering, do you guys see, or what do you guys see as the future for film? I know that's a really broad, hard-to-answer question, but do you see much of a future for film, or do you think it's in a transitional stage?
Well, I think the magic of it is that it's always ever-changing. It's always, it's always changing, so that it's giving more access to young filmmakers and youth to bring about a new sense of film and what film really means for a new generation. So I think that it's always going to be relevant. There's always going to be an audience because it's, you know, always changing.
No, it's fascinating because we can sit here in our bubbles and we berate how Sydney doesn't have a film culture, or that, you know, we are the last stand of movies and beyond us there is no hope. And then you guys come along and really actually care about movies, which is great.
We're focusing so much on how cynical we are, but the truth is we actually do love this. We're not that cynical. We go crazy at Sydney Film Festival time because, you know, like, it pulls you through. The love of movies.
Speaking for myself, I don't think you could do this for a period without having a deep, endearing love of film. And certainly, as your taste may change, then you may become, I think one word for it is cynical, but another word is you can be more selective, and that way you can expose yourself to even more avenues of cinema. I know I certainly would have done so if I hadn't come along to here and successive festivals and taken Chris and Virat's recommendations and certainly some of your recommendations. I wasn't really so sure about seeing the documentary, but I'm seeing people talk about it so passionately, I think I might just seek it out because I do want to know more about that story too. I think it's going to be an amazing crowd at that one.
As one of my favorite lines in one of my favorite novels, Possession by Ace Byrd, goes, that cynics are just closet romantics, so we're essentially closet romantics. It's just that our spirit has been broken through time, chipped away by, you know, the world, so we just need more hope.
We're changing from Fight Club to either the closet romantics or help us, we need more help.
I think it's sometimes it's just good to like enjoy a guilty pleasure film like Secret Life of Pets 2 or Minuscule, like just sit there, just enjoy it and just like, you know, have fun. that's what Sydney Film Festival is about.
Yeah, you get to be seeing Daniel Lizard with a bunch of mates who love horror, and there's no way we're not going to have an enormous amount of fun. We know you've got quite a lot of coverage coming up. It's already on Film and Revolt, and it's coming up, interviews, reviews. Where do we get there? How do we find it?
Okay, well, online on our website, filmrod.org. Also got Instagram and Facebook, so you can check us out there.
And it handles Film and Revolt, so that's pretty straightforward to look up. It's been so much fun chatting movies and chatting Sydney Film Festival. I'm sure we're going to see you at so many screenings over the course of the festival. Tiana, Amy, Amelia, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much as well.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And welcome back to the 2SER studio. It's really great having Film and Revolt on. They're a really great crew, and they've seen so much and are seeing so much, and they're always around the hub.
Yeah, as are we.
As are we, yes.
You can find me in the hub, bottle full of bub, etc.
Yeah, you can find us at the hub, not right now, because we're at the 2SR studio with Stephen Hill.
Yeah.
And
there's actually a decent chance at least some of us are in the hub as you're listening this. So
yeah, we just magically teleport ourselves and do this kind of magical thing. But also we're just kind of very...
Having a TARDIS would be damn handy for film festivals, wouldn't it?
It would. Yeah.
I had a rush between the State Theatre and to get to Daniel Isn't Real the other night from Pain and Glory, both of which we're talking about in the show, because we are talking all things Sydney Film Festival.
And when we say all things, this time we really mean all things. We're talking about too many movies.
Way too many movies. But we're starting with possibly my favourite of the festival so far, which is the new Florian Henkel von Donnersmarck film Never Look Away, which is having its Australian premiere tonight. It is starring, I think the fellow's name is Tom Schilling and Sebastian Koch.
Fantastic. He was in a great German film from not quite 10 years ago. Oh Boy. I really recommend that one. But anyway, that's
probably
not what
best
we're talking
known
about.
For Life of Others.
Yeah. No. The young guy.
Oh, you're talking about Tom Schilling.
Yeah. But yeah, Sebastian Koch plays the.
Yes, from Black Book. He plays a terrible person. And this is an epic in every sense of the word. It is the longest film I've seen at the festival and also the most rewarding. It chronicles Kurt, the Tom Schilling's character's experience as a child in Dresden, in the lead up to and during the Second World War, and then later in his life as he becomes an artist in East Germany during Soviet rule. I'm actually going to start with what I didn't like about this film, and it's very sparing. There's some exposition. There's some bits that are stated all too obviously. There is a very contrived moment at the end of the film, which is still a very cathartic moment and one of its best as we reach a revelatory crux. Having said all that, the moments are so few and far between because he takes such a time to tell the ages, and whether it be the bombing of Dresden or Kurt's experience as an artist growing up in the 50s in this era of history. It's a beautifully rendered film which deals beautifully with naturalistic art, and I absolutely loved it.
I think, I really enjoyed it because the craft is beautiful. We've got Caleb Deschanel on cinematography, but it's almost, I think, too pretty and too handsome and too conventional in a way. It's a very Hollywood feeling film, and I think this reveals itself in so many ways, like the almost soap opera like machinations in order to tie all these coincidences together, the prettiness of the characters and the prettiness of the scenery and the way it's scored. I think there's an obviousness to it that undercut some of the emotional punch it could have had, but I still got swept up in it because it's still a pretty stirring story, and it's still very well paced, well acted, well told.
And it's pretty long, right?
So yeah, I mean, three hours, six minutes.
Yeah.
But it felt like a two-hour film. That was one of the things I thought.
It flew by. I was shocked.
Yeah,
with the pace together.
Yeah.
To hold your attention with that long, I think it's pretty impressive.
Yeah. And it didn't linger in any sort of moment like that. And it really did require that actual length to be able to sort of include all of the aspects. So it wasn't like there was any sort of like Apocalypse Now sort of parts when they in the director's cut where they had 20 minutes and you go, well, in the end, was that really needed for the film? This actually, I think, I couldn't see where the director could have made too much in the way of cuts. It really did need the 3 minutes to really draw itself out. But at no time was there a period where I thought it's lingering.
I can think of something I would cut. There's a moment where the main villain is shown to be sleeping with someone other than his wife, and it serves no purpose other than
you know, in case the audience didn't get that he's the bad, bad, no good Nazi. Just one extra reason not to like this guy who is like almost like a moustache-twirling villain.
It reminds me of the moment in The Shape of Water when Michael Shannon's character abuses in the office the, from Morty, the main actress, and it's absolutely awful. And yes, we already know he's terrible. Last comment on this movie is that it is about bourgeois art. It is about art in and of itself, and it's a treatise on film and filmmaking too. It's beautiful. It's coming out in a couple of weeks.
Yeah, we'll talk about it more then. But what you just said, I can't let that go without commenting that this is a movie that opens up with all these speeches about, you know, being bold and unconventional, and then it's the most conventional movie ever. You know, so it doesn't really capture the spirit of the time, so to say.
So it does get a general release, and we will be discussing not this Wednesday show, but the Wednesday after next. The next thing we're talking about had its Australian premiere at the festival. It is the first public screening. It is Pedro Almodovar's Pain and Glory. Pain and Glory.
There's nothing moldy about this film.
No, there is not. It is starring Antonio Banderas, who won the Best Actor Award at the Cannes Film Festival. It is very autobiographical. It is a film about an aging director played by Banderas, who is questioning his creative choices and questioning his life and questioning what stories, if any, he wants to tell later in his career. I saw the premiere at the State Theatre. I absolutely adored this film. It is my favourite of his in several years. Certainly, it's an improvement on Julieta, which ended very poorly.
It's the best since The Skin I Live In.
Yeah, yes, I would agree. I would definitely agree.
Absolutely. And I would say it is also a treatise on filmmaking. There is a very elegant twist in this film, which is about biography. And the entire film says, while you can encapsulate and understand lived experience of others, it is also indiscernible to a great extent. But as filmmakers, you strive for it. And here he strived for it so much. And it's beautiful to see.
Yeah, this is my favorite film of the festival so far. I was surprised by how much I was moved by it, essentially because I think the way it talks about pain and chronic pain and living with chronic pain is something I related with very much so, especially because, you know, almost it's like chronic pain can allow you to, you know, even the things that you want to do so much, you actually don't end up doing because of how it chips away at you moment by moment and day by day. And it's not even about the mundane things. That's a separate thing altogether. But the things that you really want to do, and in this character, Banderas plays it so well, it is quite affecting, I've never seen Banderas so vulnerable ever since Almodovar's last film, probably. So I think they make a very good combination. And usually the things I hate about his directing style actually worked really well in this film together. The fast and loose way of telling the story.
Yeah, his last few films for me have felt a little bit unsatisfying in the way that they have a whole bunch of separate narrative strands and the narrative kind of just wanders around. And for me, it's kind of ended inconclusively. But in this one, there's a real emotional punch to he's found a way to work these different strands. Characters just kind of drift in and out. But this gives it a sense of a huge amount of scale in terms of the locations and the huge emotions in the main character's life that are being portrayed to through these flashbacks and through these chance meetings with characters from his past. And then you realize that it's really just an incredibly intimate story, mostly about a guy hanging around at home. But it's been rendered in such a beautiful way. And it is a film about filmmaking and and about the director himself, but I don't think it feels self-indulgent because there's, first of all, Almodovar is so generous in terms of what he gives to you. Like early in the film, there's this eye-popping animated montage, which is just gorgeous.
The title credits are stunning.
Yeah, they are. When he talks about his ailments, and it's so, but it's so funny at the same time as being sad.
Yeah, this film was actually genuinely funny, even though it deals with a very heavy subject, it doesn't feel heavy on the nose at all.
It features one in particular outrageously over-the-top comic set piece for a film like this, and yet it's hilarious. I think in the way that it's touching on nostalgia and regret and moments from your past coming back to you, I think it becomes universal as opposed to just being a self-indulgent trip. Yeah,
I'm actually going to distinguish your comments slightly. I do think it's incredibly self-indulgent, but I don't think this is a rare criticism I'll make. I don't think it's a problem simply because the craft is so exceeding.
Well, we should have a little bit more self-indulgence these days, I think, if people are, you know, really Almodovar is indulging us, I will say.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it self-indulgence. I would say the signature style of the director. Like, you know, you can see his stamp on it, which is, I think, a good thing. I don't think it's self-indulgence. I think it is just about saying, here's how I make movies and deal with it.
Yeah.
Which is a good thing.
And I'm sure we're going to be discussing this in coming months too, because it will get a general release. Mm. Pain and Glory is playing on next Saturday night at 8:30 at the Orpheum, and next Tuesday as a extra session following the festival on the 18th at 8:05 at Den of the Opera Keys. And Never Look Away, which we should have mentioned earlier, is playing tonight 8:35 at the State Theatre, Tuesday at 10 a.m. at the State Theatre, and Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Orpheum. A lot of the sessions are selling fast. The next film we're discussing is an Italian film, I believe, which I have not seen, which is Piranhas.
I have not seen Piranhas, so...
Oh, who has seen Piranhas?
We've seen it.
Yeah, we've seen it.
Look, I really liked the opening. It's familiar, I guess, to things like Once Upon a Time in America. You know, it's the young kids deciding, we're going to take over this town and banding together in Naples as a gang, making deals with, you know, other gangs, double crosses, rise to power, rise and fall. But I really liked the character details early on. I think there was a lot of attention to what are teenage boys like this, like, you know, too much testosterone, dumb, impulsive. There's really funny little character details. There's this Don character that one of the main protagonists is groveling to and is meeting at his apartment between this crotchety old guy and the young, overconfident guy is hilarious. I really like the way it's shot, capturing sun-dappled streets and ruins. It really captured the verticality of Naples in a beautiful way, I think. But and ultimately, it becomes stuck in the second half of the film in just the conventions of gangster movies. It's boring. We've seen this a million times before. It abandons the kind of moment-to-moment character basis in favor of something more plot-based, which doesn't work in its favor. And, you know, something that really epitomizes the faults of the film for me was the girlfriend character who has no purpose other than being...
All the women in this movie.
Yeah, that's right. The mother and the girlfriend are just there to be the mother and the girlfriend, and beyond that, their, you know, only attribute is long-suffering. So, you know, it's just same old.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Chris. I mean, it's a great, fun twist in the mafia story. In the first half, I loved how, you know, it's basically kids trying to pretend to be adults. Yeah. And you can see how...
Bugsy Malone.
Yeah, pretty much that. But, you know, we've all done that. We've all tried to, you know, stand in front of the mirror and recite lines from Al Capone and whatever. I don't know, I've done that. Maybe a lot of people haven't done that. So, you know, I need
not
to...
All of us.
Yeah, you need to work on my idols, clearly. But, you know...
Make you an offer like you can't refuse.
Thank you. So, you know... That was quite relatable and quite funny, but I think in the second half it does get caught up in not knowing what it wants to do. I think it's about trying to hit the beats of the mafia story, and that's less interesting. The first half is fun because you get to see all these... Actually, because, you know, since all of these are kids, it's different to... It's hard to differentiate why they're different, but the film does it really well in etching out how the idiosyncrasies are quite different from each other. So I think that was really good. It felt a really Lord of the Flies kind of feel to it. But in the second half, it just gets caught up in telling a straight-out gangster story, like John Dillinger kind of thing, on the run, which is kind of boring.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Piranhas is screening tomorrow at 4 p.m. at the Rand of Grits. The next film we're talking about is one I regret I actually missed, and it's The Souvenir.
Yeah, The Souvenir is it's lovely. It's it took me a while to actually settle in, because the initial response to it takes you about an hour or so to settle in and actually realize how affecting it is.
It's a very strangely framed and paced film by conventional standards, because we major moments are skipped over. It's going for a fragments of memory kind of feeling, where you might... a scene might open up where characters are referring to something that's happened earlier without ever fully explaining it to the audience. But I never found it hard to follow. I think it really respects the audience's intelligence. That style for me becomes kind of hypnotic after a while, because
it does.
Yeah, it's portraying kind of very mundane, in some sense, scenes. And yet there's a poetry to it. And I think, you know, the textures, like it really feels like... Because this is an autobiographical film from a filmmaker.
Yeah, once again, I think, After Pain and Glory.
So yeah, I saw them in a double bill, too.
Wow. Oh, yeah.
They have quite a bit in common. But the way it's been edited and the way it's been shot as well really, I think, evokes the feeling of memories coming back to you. There's this recurring device of moving from to handheld kind of flickery images, which I took to be the main character seeing things as real, you know, in terms of her art, you know, having a moment in her real life. Because it,
there's a dreamlike quality to it. Yeah. You never know when you're in the surreal and when you're in the real.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that this film is about having your life informing your art and the process of that starting to happen for this person. I really like that way that Joanna Hogg, in my opinion, I think that what she was doing was finding a way to, you know, visualize through her main character's eyes her medium, her filmmaking being influenced by the moments as they happen.
Yeah, I think it'll be helpful to contextualize a bit about what the film is about for our listeners. So this is a film by Joanna Hogg. It is the first part of maybe, there's a second part in progress. It's basically autobiographical about a young female protagonist who's trying to discover herself, who wants to become a filmmaker. And she goes to a film school in
early
in
to mid-20s.
Yeah, and there's a lot of fun textures about how film school functions, and I think there's a lot of funny scenes about people in film school and what they're like and how pretentious they can be. So I think it's a very interesting, funny thing.
What? No.
Yeah. No. Yeah. I know. None of these are here, of course. You know,
was,
we're all.
It wasn't playing at all. Just
It was though. It didn't spend ages condescending about
the
art people.
All.
You know,
no.
there's something. This film felt to me really honest.
It is honest because when they're talking about Psycho and the scene in Psycho, then you can see the scenes after that are framed like that. So it's very interesting how the film is a meta narrative in itself, about it uses a lot of the things it's talking about in the very scenes after it. So it's interesting. But the main kind of attraction of the story is the relationship the protagonist has with another character who is going through some problems of their own and how. Mm-hmm. They're kind of self-destructive for each other. So it's an interesting, once again, you know, I know a lot of people like that in my life, so I felt that a bit too close to home.
It's very much about inexperience and people, you know, a young person being manipulated essentially by a self-destructive person.
It's a story of manipulation, and it's quite harrowing in that sense, but it dawns on you. But it's never heavy.
But he's a great character because you still believe he loves her. And you still believe... that there are things about him that are incredibly charming and attractive, despite
which
all his flaws.
A lot of those characters are in real life too. So I guess it does hit close to home. Tilda Swinton is in there as well in a very sort of not
her daughter
mainstream
is playing
role.
The lead,
which is interesting.
Real life mother and daughter.
Yeah.
So that is The Souvenir. It is playing again on Friday night at 6:15 at the Hayden Orpheum and Sunday at 4:45 at the Ritz. The latter session is sold out, but usually tickets pop up individual
keep
sessions
an eye out.
Become available.
Do keep an eye out.
The next film we're talking about is one I saw on Friday night, which is The Extraordinary Journey of Celeste Garcia. It is a Cuban sci-fi about Celeste, who finds out, along with the rest of Cuba, that aliens have ingratiated themselves into society and have lived among everyone and have now offered so many people to visit their planet. So part of the film is her deciding what she will do, whether she will take up this offer, and the follow-through and impact of that. I found the premise and the lead incredibly charming. They complemented each other very well. She was incredibly well cast. I found the first act of this film, which I just referred to, where this conflict is very much more apparent, the most interesting. I wish there'd be more sci-fi elements to it. There was a lot of sci-fi for a standard sci-fi film. There was also, as is the case in many sci-fis, a very hackneyed, convenient romance.
I didn't get the sense that this is really a sci-fi film without having seen it. It sounds to me just like a strange
genre flick, which
I was fascinated of how much of it was having a look at the sort of the very planned Cuban society. Of there's a mild sort of satirical commentary going through the veins, but I mean it's very cautious, sort of like the Russian comedies. If you think of some of the Russian comedies that were sort of made in the sort of 70s or so, I think there's a sort of similarity in that sort of having a sort of mildly sort of modern sort of giggle at sort of Cuban society, but in a way that can't, without any of the sort of sharp edges that sort of are much more, if it were to go into sort of darker territory. But I thought that was quite like that. The levity actually worked in its favour, having that sort of, it's quite a gentle film. And some of the characters, I would actually like to spend more time on some of the other characters around. I thought that was quite fascinating. I thought that the tangos, the sort of closeted gay tango singer, I thought was a really fascinating character that was along. And I just thought, there was a few characters, I just thought, it would have been interesting to have a bit more of a sort of broader, cosmology about the decision, why people made the decision. We need to leave Cuba and to get on this spaceship to nowhere. Is it the sort of to travel somewhere unknown. I just thought that would have been interesting to see that explored a bit more. But there's some great humorous things, like this sort of virtual reality with a giant chicken, and there's little sort of moments with this sort of, yeah, with something totally off the ball, which is sort of, I think that, you know, when you see the description of the film, I think that's what would draw most of the people to it, is this is something that you are not going to, you know, that's what's, you know, great as a festival choice, is this a sort of film that you're not going to encounter on your usual visits to the cinema.
No, I certainly like the sequences, the bunks with where we introduced a few of those characters. My favorite was the drill instructor / organizer, who was hilarious with every, dripping with disdain with every line with how she addressed the crowd. The other event I really enjoyed was the way that the other world was depicted, the glimpses we got. It's very much like ours, except some animals are much bigger than it might be expected. There was a particularly great visual of a giant fowl, which I thoroughly enjoyed. That was The Extraordinary Journey of Celeste Garcia. It is playing on next Sunday at 4:45 at Event Cinemas George Street. The next film we are talking about is one that Verona and I caught on opening night. It was the first film at the festival proper, which is Ghost Town Anthology. It's from director, Quebecois director, I think Denis Coterre, is that his pronunciation? Yeah. And it is a film where in a town of 221 people, a small Quebecois town, a young man dies, and then a while after that, the dead start to come to life, but don't do a lot.
They don't.
And what struck me about this movie is the disparity in the storytelling. The first 8 minutes is just ideal narrative storytelling. There's not a lot of dialogue. You have cause to effect. You have a setup done very well over six scenes. You learn all about the town, the character of the town. You learn all about the main characters, whether it be the family of the deceased or the mayor or a few of the other figures. And then they spend about 45 minutes redoing the stuff because they probably thought they hadn't done it properly, but they had. To take an hour to get to the main story, and then nothing happens. There's some very blatant symbolism. And what really got me about this film, and you see it with a lot of the Brett Gelman films, they like to use, and A Ghost Story, which I think actually I know Virat raised with me, it's using similar deadpan pacing to tell a dramatic story. It worked in A Ghost Story because it was just inherently funny in some senses by the longevity of the shots and what they were supposed to endure in many senses. There's nothing like that here. I think it's very poorly framed for the type of pacing and the type of story they want to tell. It wasn't funny. If I'm making it sound like it's funny, it's not. And it's actually not one I would recommend. It spirals out after the first 8 or 10 minutes and does not pick up from there.
Yeah, I mean, this was just a drag, honestly. It was quite hard to sit through. Also, I sat through a short before it, which is also problematic in the sense that I was just like, it didn't set the mood. So I think, you know, I was predisposed to be like, oh my God, it's going to be a long night. And it ended up being a long night anyway. And it sort of continued, you know, I guess zombies are the sort of festival theme of this year. I guess a lot of zombie movies are in the program, as last year's theme was something else entirely, which we're not going to touch upon again. But, you know, it's I'm glad that's changed to zombies this year. But mostly I think this film, what I hated about it is trying to go for a mood piece, but there is no mood to it. Like, you know, there is nothing. It's quite bland, quite empty. The sparseness of the landscape is interesting because, you know, it's cold, it's harsh, and you can see that's having an effect on the mood of the people because, you know, there's nothing there. And it's talking about political ramifications of literally all, you know, Midwestern towns leaving and going to the city and how they've become literal ghost towns. So there is something...
Metaphor,
there.
You get it?
Exactly, metaphors, you know, so they're literal ghost towns of people who've moved out to the cities and then they've left vacant spaces of nothing to occupy. So, you know, but, you know, it's too blatant, it's too on the nose. Much better watching Frederick Wiseman's Monrovia, Indiana, yeah. Which does that much better and in a much more interesting way. This was just sad and not in a good way.
So what is sad and not in a good way is Ghost Town Anthology at Wednesday 9 p.m. on the 12th of June in the Vent Cinemas, George Street.
Briefly, next film. Oh, sorry, I wanted to use the opportunity to segue into Monrovia, Indiana. This is one... It starts out really well. I think I really... I was talking to Ian Barr about it, and my tired brain is going to default to stealing some of the things he said. I really... Yeah, I really admire his approach, the way that he's so patient and just lets you observe natural rhythms and find out, you know, the character of these people just by immersing you in the town and in the way they talk to each other. But I did find that at 2 hours and 20 minutes, it did feel maybe twice as long as it really needed to be. I understand that the point is to immerse you in a space, but there's a point where I felt like the point was made.
It's still a shorter Wiseman film, though, compared to his other ones, so I guess.
Yeah.
He's learning his lesson.
So Ghost Town Anthology mentioned, Monrovia, Indiana is playing, let me just bring it up, is playing on the 15th, the Saturday, and then the Opera Keys at midday. Next film we're talking about is, which one I haven't seen, Queen of Hearts.
Yeah, Queen of Hearts. I think this has been one of the best films I've seen so far in the festival. A Danish film, and it was, you know, from the premise of the title, it's one of those films that's either going to actually deliver or it's going to be a massive disappointment. It's really easy to have been, it could easily have been a very overwrought melodrama, but I thought this really was a very, very focused film based about this a children's rights advocate who suddenly gets involved in a sexual relationship with her son-in-law who has a troubled, also, you know, has a troubled past, and it's actually a really, I mean, very well directed and very focused in its approach. The lead actress, I mean, the performance is very strong. It isn't just a sort of Nordic ice lady, which we've sort of seen some really powerful performances. I thought this has had some really measured things. And yeah, I'd certainly thought. I mean, this was also a film I saw, was it about 8:30 or something on a day when I, you know, was up. That was like the fourth film. So often, if those films don't capture your attention, your concentration slips. And this, my concentration didn't slip at all within, you know, 1 moment of this film. I thought this didn't have, you know, it didn't have too much in the way that sort of made your mind wander too much. And but it wasn't in any way a sort of just a nice sort of safe thriller where it was leading. I thought, yeah, certainly one of the best films I've seen so far in this festival.
Wow, I guess we're going to be the opposite side of the spectrum, Stephen, for this one. You know, I've already kind of thrashed its film and the Film in Revolt. Sorry. I'm just meshing words together now. But what I felt, look, it's got an interesting premise, especially about manipulation once again and guilt that comes from, because, you know, the main protagonist is a children's rights advocate, as you mentioned, and she gets involved in a youngish, relationship with a youngish person herself. And that the kind of guilt that comes from that is interesting, and what she does and the actions she takes are quite questionable, if we can say so. But it kind of reminded me a bit of the Russian film from last year. I'm forgetting, from the Russian filmmaker who's very famous.
Leviathan?
Loveless.
Loveless.
Oh, yeah, okay. Loveless, yeah. Yeah.
So I guess a lot of it is that about, you know, how just, you know, terrible people making terrible decisions in this terrible town. It's just, you know, it just became relentless after a while for me. And it just, like, you know, it tries to go in interesting directions, but the only directions it can go on are very predictable. And then you become that everyone is kind of just bad. You know, in this world, nobody's looking at it from an outside-in perspective, and everyone's too involved and just looking out for themselves. It just became quite relentlessly predictable in that sense. But still, I agree with you. The lead protagonist's performance was very good. She carried the whole film on her shoulders practically. There was nobody else who was that interesting. Unfortunately, we didn't get much time to develop all the other characters as much, but she did a brilliant job. But yeah, the film didn't quite work for me.
So I thought the husband's performance also was very solid too. I thought he put in a very good performance too. Her offside, I thought, particularly as the film develops, we get much more of a perspective of him and that whole thing of him doubting himself and his sort of questioning. Yeah, so I thought that sort of uncertainty, I think, I thought that was played quite well.
Fair enough.
So that was Queen of Hearts. It is screening on Friday the 14th at the State Theatre at 2 p.m. The next film we're talking about is one Chris and I saw, and it is getting a general release via Mad Men. It is Apollo 11. Now, you may think that there's not a lot to say about the moon landing. It is the 50th anniversary coming up, especially after First Man came out last year. However, we didn't like First Man. This is a lot better than First Man. It uses archival footage. The filmmaker sifted through 11,000 hours of footage to make us footage, some we've seen, some we haven't. There is a particularly notable sequence, which is staged very similarly to a sequence in Interstellar, which I found much more captivating, as there is a sequence stage very similar to one in First Man regarding the actual moon landing.
The difference
is done much, much better.
The difference is that in Interstellar, it made no sense to limit the camera, you know, to some of the angles Nolan did in a dumb attempt at realism. Whereas here, this is, you know, real.
There was no drone hanging out up there.
Exactly. The camera is stuck to the machine, and knowing that this is real, that invests that kind, you know, those kinds of sequences with so much more tension, even obviously knowing the outcome, this is well put together enough that it really sustains interest and excitement, I would say.
Wow. It felt like an action movie, especially during the liftoff sequence.
Yeah. Dumb attempted realism. Wow, that's harsh.
No, I do think I'm always up for a good Nolan slam. but a lot of this footage is fairly familiar to me. If you've seen some other recent Moon documentaries, the marketing angle of, you know, amazing new footage isn't so incredible. It's more the effort of editing all of this together so that it resembles a conventional narrative. It still does feel a little bit distancing as it drags on into the second half to have basically no dialogue and the only sound we're hearing being that from radio. And maybe that reveals the artificiality of the construction with regard to the sound effects and the music a little bit in a way that became slightly distracting. But it's still really stirring. I thought this is a very well put together action thriller, really, out of the original footage.
It's an action movie, and it's much better than, I think, any of the space exploration ones I've seen. I'd include Interstellar in that. I didn't mind. I thought it was average and overrated. But this was really good by Todd Douglas Miller. It screens for the first time tomorrow at 9:30 at the State Theatre AM, Saturday 15th of June at 2 p.m., and Sunday the 16th of June at 1:45 at the Hayden Orpheum. The next film we're talking about is one Chris and I caught together. It is Dirty God. It is playing in the official competition from director Sacha Polak and starring Vicky Knight. We discussed, I think, brief last week. It is about a victim of a very brutal acid attack in East London and recovering from this attack at the outset of being discharged from hospital and trying to acclimatize back to her life and finding it in many respects, understandably, very difficult. I found this is one of my favorite films of the festival. Of the ones I've seen, I don't think Never Look Away is in the official competition. It might be my favorite of the official competition so far.
Never Look Away is in the official competition.
Never Look Away. Oh, all right. Then, well, I'm going to give it to Florian, but this is certainly a very serious contender. What I liked about this film, what I liked in the main is simply that I think would have been an enormous temptation to depict Vicky Knight's character in one particular way. However, as I mentioned in the Film in the Vault discussion, there are many aspects to her which are not glamorous, which are irredeeming, and she was an incredibly multifaceted character, and I like that the film felt that they could and go in this direction, and it led to a very rich portrait to her, which I really appreciated.
In a lot of ways, this reminds me of a lot of recent kind of British social realist movies. A lot of people, I think, will think of Fish Tank and the relationship between the single mother and the lead character, and in the way that she's portrayed in a somewhat unflattering way. But yeah, what separates this film, obviously, is the focus on the physical disfigurement. And it's a character who, I think, probably feels like she doesn't really have anything to base her identity or her pride in herself on except for her beauty, and then the struggle when that's taken away from her. But it focuses on that, you know, like the value of the physical beauty in our society, and the struggle for people and the disadvantage of people who, you know, one way or another don't have it, without really overplaying its hand. A lot of the details feel very genuine and true. I really liked it. I thought some of this symbolism was a little overstretched. There's a terrible moment where the title gets dropped.
Oh, bad roll credits moment.
The title gets dropped in a way where the character speaks in this very plain way. You know, she's meant to be an uneducated, lower working class person, and then suddenly she drops this very poetic line about, "My God isn't like yours. My God is a dirty God." Beyond what does that mean, beyond being a catchy line and a catchy title, it was so out of place for her character and the interactions depicted in the film up until then. I don't know. There's something about these kinds of films that I wonder, though, where it's like the focus on misery, even though it wasn't relentless, because, obviously darkness is earned with this subject matter. But I wonder if there's a degree of condescension to a lot of these films. You know, like it is sympathetic to the working class, but it's everyone in this film is terrible to each other. And I wonder if there's a degree of, you know, empathy, but really it's a privileged person, you know, behind a camera sneering at the subject matter in a way, like, you know, benevolent, but benevolent classism, I suppose, because there's very few positive, the way these people screw each other over constantly is pretty ugly if you think about it.
It's a loveless hangover is what you're suggesting.
I don't know. I mean, I kind of thought, I mean, the mother character, like, I thought it was more the sort of social positions. I mean, they're all sort of having their own difficulties with life.
There is context and reason given for that to be the case. Yeah. But it's still just like everyone's portrayed that way, like her friends as well. Mm. That I sort of started to think that, you know.
I didn't find that. Mm. Right. I honestly didn't. I didn't get that impression. I feel it promoted what I think will be an extraordinarily relatable experience for many. Mm. And yes, I appreciate that a lot of these were lousy characters, but
you do really come to empathize with the main character.
You absolutely do, without question. But I feel this is but one story, and certainly there are these figures that pervade every corner of society. I'm going to highlight.
I think it's certainly one of the standout films too. I was very impressed with it too, so I just would like to back that up. I thought also what was interesting too is that sort of the mixture of her being in one way such this immensely rebellious character and yet at the same time very conformist, and that kind of duality and how that sort of played out, and the sort of those humorous scenes within which at the call center. And also that willingness to, I think, you know, to be exposed. Also those scenes about, you know, on the sex cam, and that was actually quite. And I didn't think it was overplayed. I thought that was a real vulnerability in that to actually show that. And I thought that took a fair bit of courage to actually sort of
good for Vicki Knight. She's a 23-year-old actress.
Yeah,
and she was great in this. And she's coming to Australia for the festival, which is phenomenal.
Oh, fabulous! Well, yes, it's certainly one we should check out.
I guess I should catch it. I guess considering the polarizing opinions.
It's a very I did enjoy it. It's very empathetic and it does draw you into her experience.
Last thing I'll comment about this film, my favorite scene, and it's a passing scene, is when she's outside the call center and I think she throws something or spits at a gentleman who's passing, and he looks back at her and is about to say something, but I think he notices her appearance, and I think this is made quite explicit in the film, looks at her for a bit and then decides not to. And that little interaction, it's wordless, it's symbolic, but it captures so much about what makes this film distinct and idiosyncratic. And there are many moments like this, and I'd strongly recommend seeing it. It is screening on, for the first time, Australian premiere Wednesday night, 6:30 at the State Theatre, Thursday morning, 11:40 at the State Theatre, and Saturday afternoon, 2 p.m. at the Rand Ritz. The next film we are talking about is Agnes by Varda.
Yeah, okay. I was a little disappointed, to be honest with you. And I don't know. I thought the first half was quite interesting, but I mean, I just thought as a documentary, I didn't think it really added much to what you'd already seen of her fabulous work. And I thought there was, I mean, there's really go and see the 10 films, and I think there was much more richness in that than I thought. I mean, I just felt it was too hurriedly put together at the end. I don't know what you thought, Chris.
I haven't caught it yet. I'll be catching it next week. But I've heard of a few people say that it's covering a lot of the same ground that The Beaches of Agnes, which is playing in the program, covered already, but better.
Yeah. Interesting, Stephen, that you're on the opposite side of the fence, because I really loved it. But maybe that's because it was a nostalgic trip for me. You know, in a lot of the sense, it is, yes, it's covering the same subjects, but you get more of a definitive personal statement from Varda in this one, that she's trying to actually say something that she hasn't, and she's like, you know, trying to capping it all off for you. You know, in a way, it is kind of a good send off if you can get that. You know, you know, it's almost her getting the chance to say, this is my final word on my own filmography, which is without being self indulgent once again.
Sorry, just to correct what I said before, that I meant that Beaches of Agnes handled it better.
Yeah. So that is Varda by Agnes, excuse me, not Agnes by Varda. It screens Saturday the 15th at 4:50 p.m. at Dendy Opera Keys. We'll be back on Wednesday talking in a lot more detail about the Sydney Film Festival, a lot of films that have screened, a lot of films that will be screening. I want to thank the Film and Revolt crew, Amelia, Amy, and Tiana for joining us, as well as Lee Russell from Film and Revolt. And I'd like to thank Stephen Hill for joining us, talking all things Sydney Film Festival. Stephen, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you. Oh, thanks for having me.
So please do come to the festival. Check out the Hub. Subscribe on iTunes and Spotify. It's a really great environment, and you can just immerse yourself in film. See three or four a day if you want to. We certainly are, and it's just an enormous great time.
Going to battle on.
It's been Glenn Falkenstein, Chris Evans, and Brett Lew. Have a wonderful night. Enjoy movies. Good night.
Bye.
Good night.